Stop me if you've heard this one. In October 1917, a power-mad group of hardcore revolutionaries, known by the name that struck fear in the hearts of freedom-loving peoples throughout the world, the Bolsheviks, managed, through a fluke in history, to overthrow the legitimate and democratic government of Russia. The Bolsheviks were driven by their fanatic belief in the twisted ideology of the German philosopher Karl Marx, who stressed the need for the total destruction of the existing world order. The Bolsheviks were bent on world domination and led by the power-hungry Vladimir Lenin, the evil genius Leon Trotsky, and the murderous sociopath Joseph Stalin. This October Revolution was not a mass movement of workers and peasants, despite their propaganda. It was instead an illegitimate putsch. If not for this unnatural deviation in its development, Russia would have become a liberal free market democracy and taken its place alongside the US, Britain, and France as they stood victorious at the end of World War I. Alas, instead, Lenin set Russia on a course of ruin, destruction, and slaughter that would terrorize both the Russian people as well as the rest of the God-fearing, freedom-loving democratic world for decades. He immediately outlawed all other parties and political groups, declared civil war on his political enemies, and began the Red Terror, a campaign of political repression that brought only chaos and ruin. The Bolsheviks had committed their illegal usurpation in the name of the nation's workers and peasants. Now, though, they showed their true colors as they consolidated power and turned against the very people they had claimed to be fighting for. Famine and economic destruction became widespread. The Bolsheviks did away with any pretenses of democracy and renamed themselves the Communists, a term synonymous with authoritarianism. They resurrected the Russian Empire of Tsar's past, but gave it a new name, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR. Eventually, the stress of being so evil got to Comrade Lenin, and he died in 1924. But before the masses could breathe a sigh of relief and hope for a turn in their fortunes, that murderous sociopath Stalin ruthlessly seized power, turning on the rest of the Bolsheviks, and especially his arch-rival, Trotsky. The rise of Stalin to power pushed the hapless citizens of the Soviet Union out of the frying pan and straight into the fire. Over the next three decades, Stalin would nakedly pursue his own self-aggrandizement and power. He murdered political rivals, real and perceived, at the drop of a hat. He had no qualms about condemning his enslaved countrymen to being worked to death in the gulags. His misguided economic policies brought on endless famine through collectivization, and political repression in the Stalinist purges resulted in an incalculable number of innocent human lives being extinguished. Incalculable, but let's just call it 100 million, since that's such a nice, round figure. Stalin and his Bolsheviks lived high on the hog, enjoying every material comfort known to exist at the time, while the rest of the nation toiled and suffered and died. But there would be a price to pay. When World War II came around and Hitler invaded, the communists were caught completely unaware. The economic destruction wrought by the pursuit of socialist economics, combined with the years of repression, left the Soviet Union wide open to attack. And had it not been for that most stalwart ally of the Russian people, General Winter, as well as Hitler's own misguided war plan and unforced errors, the Nazis would have rid the world of the communist scourge for good. But the Soviets got lucky and were able to hold on until the Americans finally landed in France in 1944. The D-Day invasion marked the beginning of the end of the evil Third Reich, and against the military might of the democratic and free market United States, the Nazis disintegrated. The Soviet Union was saved by the imperialist swine they so despised. But of course, Stalin being Stalin, as soon as the opportunity presented itself, he claimed all credit for himself and his beloved communism. He betrayed his fellow allied heads of state, Roosevelt and then Truman from the US, and Churchill from the UK, and went about imposing communism on as many countries as he could in the post-war chaos. It was only due to the savvy and adept political maneuverings of the US and the UK that the Soviet Union's attempt at a communist takeover of the totality of Europe was avoided. Alas, some nations in Central and Eastern Europe, including part of Germany, did fall to the communists. But in order to avoid World War III, these new victims of communism would have to suffer, at least until the West could find a way to smuggle democracy into their borders. Tensions only rose when the Soviets acquired nuclear missile capabilities in 1949, which they were only able to do after stealing secrets from the U.S. nuclear program through their vast network of spies. Nuclear bombs had the capacity to destroy life on the planet. They were safely entrusted in the hands of the United States, who was regrettably forced to use them to end the war with Japan. But that had been in the pursuit of peace and freedom. The Soviets, however, were a different story. They had always been, and still were, hell-bent on world domination. Nuclear weapons falling into these wrong hands signaled that the stakes in the ideological struggle between the tyrannical, repressive, communist East and the democratic, free, capitalist West would be nothing less than the continued existence of organized human life on the planet. Any direct military conflict between the U.S. and the Soviet Union could unleash nuclear Armageddon, and so a traditional hot war was out of the question. Instead, a cold war would have to be fought for the soul of humanity. Stalin died in 1953 and was succeeded by Nikita Khrushchev, a bumbling and mentally imbalanced communist who, nevertheless, used his cunning wiles to begin threatening the United States from a new position, the highest ground there could be, space. Through satellites and even manned spaceflight, the Soviets could have rained down destruction on the free world. But the United States was not about to just let this happen. The government mobilized its forces and won the space race when it landed the first human beings on the moon, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, followed by several more of their astronaut colleagues. American capitalism had proven itself superior to Soviet communism yet again. Khrushchev, however, could not leave well enough alone on Earth. Not content with their empire in Eastern Europe, as well as more recent acquisitions in China and Korea, the Soviets engineered yet another successful and illegal overthrow of a legitimate government, but this time right off the coast of Florida. The U.S. had tried valiantly to free the island of Cuba from their new communist overlords, but they were thwarted time and again by the crafty, dangerous new communist dictator Fidel Castro. Khrushchev, believing the capitalists to be weak, became convinced he could sneak nuclear missiles onto Cuba in order to surround, threaten, and even destroy the last bastion of capitalist freedom in the world. Soviet hubris was on full display. The so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, however, did not turn into World War III, only thanks to the cool-headedness of the U.S. President, John F. Kennedy. He managed to deftly outmaneuver the Soviets both politically and strategically, leaving Khrushchev's head spinning and his position so weakened in his own party that he was removed from power just a few short months later. At least for now, the free world breathed a little more easily and slept a little more soundly, thanks to the United States. Eventually, Cold War tensions eased as the balance of power slowly shifted toward the capitalists. Of course, the Soviets would have been happy to launch their nuclear weapons in order to exterminate freedom and capitalism from the globe, but had only been deterred by the strategic doctrine of mutually assured destruction, or MAD, the knowledge that they, too, would be destroyed if they ever launched a single nuke. Thus, the Soviet Union was forced into a passive position by Cold War strategic defeats in the space race, Cuba, and the arms race. But the communists never really abandoned their aspirations for more territory and world domination. So they eagerly invaded their neighbor in Central Asia, Afghanistan, in 1979. The Soviets would have succeeded in their quest to subjugate the Afghans to their ideology had it not been for noble CIA intervention in support of the Afghan freedom fighters, including one Osama bin Laden. Through the support of the United States, the Mujahideen of Afghanistan successfully dealt a crushing military defeat to the communists. In the meanwhile, the Soviet economy, which had always been based on the use of force and coercion by the state, started to falter. The Soviet premier, Leonid Brezhnev, was too old and, in the end, too senile to effectively steer the Soviet state, contributing to the general malaise in the country. With the backward Marxist economy stagnating and the Afghanistan invasion going badly, the collapse of the country only accelerated. Once Brezhnev passed away, he was succeeded by Yuri Andropov, who was himself so old he lasted a mere 2 years in office. His successor, Konstantin Chernenko, was yet another senile old man, and himself lasted a scant 13 months in office. It seemed the Communist Party had exhausted its supply of leaders, and the Soviet Union was doomed, until Mikhail Gorbachev was named leader of the Soviet Union in 1985. He was young, energetic, and full of ideas for how to revitalize the Soviet Union. He instituted the economic policy of perestroika and the social policy of glasnost, with the goals of revitalizing the economy and infusing Soviet society with democracy for the first time. But alas, the policies of perestroika and glasnost were like opening the doors to a store with an eager mob outside. As soon as these new policies were implemented, the Soviet system was overwhelmed. The rot at its core was laid bare. It became abundantly clear to everyone that socialism, or communism, or Marxism, or whatever the Soviet Union claimed to profess, was morally and economically bankrupt. It was incapable of meeting basic human needs, and more importantly, it was simply unable to align itself with the truth of human nature. You see, human beings are, by nature, freedom-loving creatures, and there is no way they prefer more to express their freedom than through completely rational capitalist economic activity, because capitalism is the purest expression of freedom and the only truly natural way to organize a society. But socialism was, is, and always had been based on coercion and irrational top-down economic activity. That had never changed, not since the days of Lenin and Stalin. So when Gorbachev loosened the reins even just a tiny bit, he inadvertently allowed human nature to burst forth like water breaking through a dam and was overwhelmed in the resulting deluge. Of course, we cannot forget the role in all of this of the U.S. President Ronald Reagan. Reagan, with his keen political senses, perceived the time was right to deal the killing stroke to the Soviet Union and communism. Visiting Berlin, he implored Gorbachev to tear down the wall. His speech was so stirring and spoke so directly to that basic human longing for freedom and capitalism that it was there and then the democratic aspirations of the peoples of Eastern Europe burst forth from their hearts, and one by one, the oppressive communist regimes fell like dominoes. Yes, Reagan had single-handedly won the Cold War of the last 40 years, stripped the Soviet Union of its colonies, and left it isolated and alone. Finally, in 1991, Boris Yeltsin, a model Russian citizen who had always dreamed of freeing his people from the Soviet yoke, saw his chance and took it. He challenged Gorbachev in the political sphere and emerged victorious. On the 25th of December, 1991, in the face of overwhelming political unrest fueled by human love of democracy and capitalism and a socialist economy that had utterly collapsed, Gorbachev announced he was dissolving the Soviet Union. It was truly a Christmas miracle. Yeltsin then took over in Russia and ushered in a new age of political and economic liberalization. Capitalism swept into the wasteland left behind by communism. The peoples of the former Soviet Union rejoiced in their newfound freedom. They cheered as bread, eggs, and blue jeans appeared on their shelves. They applauded as a handful of oligarchs emerged from the rubble to lead them into the economic promised land. And at the end of the 1990s, after a decade of unqualified success in the Russian economy brought on by the wonders of the free market, and with the unshakable bedrock of a new Russian democracy laid, with a new century dawning, Yeltsin handed the torch to his successor, Vladimir Putin. And from that day forward, Russia lived happily ever after. Hi, my name is Daniel, and you're listening to my new podcast, The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. What you just heard is a summarization, admittedly an overly dramatic one, of the history of the Soviet Union as told in the United States, where I was born and raised. Now, you might say I laid it on a bit thick in some spots, but when I was in high school in my 20th century history class, shout out to Mr. Long if you're listening, the general outline presented to us was the aggressive Bolsheviks take over a country, the psychopath Stalin murders everyone with a body count that would make Jason Voorhees jealous, the communists drive the entire country into the ground with their completely ridiculous economic policies, until the insanity of it all finally causes the entire madhouse to come crashing down. But even when I was in high school, I couldn't shake this nagging question. Was it really like that? How could millions of people live like that for so long? How could such an insane, irrational system continue for 75 years? I mean, it couldn't have been that bad, right? When I got to college, I majored in Russian area studies, where my education about the Soviet Union involved, for the most part, more details about how evil and irrational the Soviet system was, this time with a sheen of academic legitimacy. I graduated in May 2008, which, if you don't know, was the best year ever to be entering the job market, because everything on Wall Street was A-OK, and I moved to Moscow for the following 3 years. I taught English, got married, and continued my study of the Russian language, becoming fluent. From there, my wife and I decided to move to the U.S. so I could pursue a master's degree. This involved even more academic literature about how screwed up everything in the USSR had been. Even after receiving my degrees, I never stopped learning or reading about the Soviet Union. But the more I looked for answers in standard university textbooks and popular histories to how the Soviet Union worked and managed to last for so long if it was truly irrational, the more questions I had. The books I was reading all emphasized the negative aspects of the Soviet Union, but never answered the questions that lay at the heart of my inquiry. What was the Soviet Union? How did its government function? If communism had been so out of alignment with true human nature, how could it have lasted for so long? How could it simultaneously be a hopelessly backward economic system, yet threaten world security? If it was so backward, how did it achieve the world historic feats of defeating Nazism, putting the first people in space, and, perhaps the greatest contribution to world culture of all time, Tetris? As I kept digging, I could not escape the feeling that I had been denied ready access to certain information, almost as if an attempt had been made to lead me to predetermined conclusions about the nature of capitalism, communism, and human society. I eventually realized that what I needed to do was to learn what the Soviets themselves thought they were trying to do. For that, I had to read what they had to say themselves, starting with one Vladimir Lenin. But with Lenin being so heavily influenced by Karl Marx, I really had to start with him. And then, a funny thing happened. The more I read what these two in particular had to say, the more I found myself agreeing with them. After a while, I concluded, hey, these guys are basically right. Yes, my dark secret is, my study of the USSR led to me becoming a communist. But don't worry, dear listener. I promise you, this is not a podcast intent on brainwashing you against capitalism or indoctrinating you into the ranks of Marxism. There are already plenty of podcasts and YouTube channels for that, and you should definitely seek them out. No, what I want to do here is share this new perspective I've gained on the Soviet Union. The more I read, the more I form an understanding of the Soviet Union that runs completely counter to what I was taught in my formal education, and the more I want to just get that information out there. Now, there is already a ton of content that touches on just about every aspect of Soviet history. However, I was surprised to learn that there is no one-stop shop for the entire history of the Soviet Union, no singular place that contains the information. So, as crazy as it sounds, that's what I hope to achieve here. To give some specifics about what the format of this podcast will be, I've come up with 4 broad spheres of inquiry over the entirety of Soviet history: the political, the economic, the cultural, and the international. I am going to trace all 4 of these spheres as they developed and changed, starting with the Russian Revolution of 1917 and ending with the dissolution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics in 1991. This narrative will be told mainly from the Marxist-Leninist perspective to which I ascribe. But rest assured, I'm not going to just feed you apologies for Stalin and insist the communists were always and everywhere the good guys. The Soviet Union was not a utopia. Utopias do not and cannot exist, not even socialist ones. One of the central tenets of Marxism is the need for an accurate and sober understanding of history. As a Marxist-Leninist, I truly do believe that we, as a species, must move past capitalism if we are to survive. Not only because I believe socialism and communism are more humane societies, not only because I believe they are more economically democratic modes of production and therefore more economically rational societies, but because I, like many of my fellow millennials and the younger Zoomers out there, can see with my own eyes how capitalism is failing to meet the material needs of people around the world while destroying our ecology and perpetuating endless conflict. Just in the United States, in my lifetime, we've lived through terrorist attacks, decades of wars in foreign countries, a pandemic that killed millions, and an economic upheaval that almost completely destroys all the progress we've managed to make every 10 years or so, all with the threat of ecological collapse looming on the horizon. And if we are actually to make a definite break with capitalism, it behooves us to study what others who have tried the same have done. The Soviet Union is not the only example of such an attempt at building a new world. It is arguable if it was even the best. But it was the first example in world history where the common peoples of an entire country actually succeeded in overthrowing their capitalist class, then avoided being overthrown themselves in the ensuing reaction, and tried building their own society. And that makes it one of the most important topics of study for anti-capitalists everywhere. One of Marx's most famous quotes from his Theses on Feuerbach is, "The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it." If leftists around the world, be they Marxist-Leninists like me, anarchists, social democrats, whatever, are to build that better world we want, we need to know what the Soviet Union got right and what it got wrong. Now, if you're American like me, or just generally grew up in the West, particularly after 1991, you're familiar with a lot of the arguments and narratives I mentioned in my tongue-in-cheek intro. And some of you, even if you consider yourselves on the left, might be loath to even entertain the idea that Stalin was not a mass murderer, or that he was justified in doing what he did. If that is you, please do not worry. As I said before, I am not going to twist everything in an insane attempt to justify everything the Soviets did. All I ask is, as you listen to the show, you keep an open mind. I mentioned my own experience in academia with learning about the Soviet Union and how myopic the information was, but that pales in comparison to the wider propaganda about socialism and communism floating around the zeitgeist, and everything from television to movies, from news channels to video games. As we move through the narrative, I'm going to do my best to not only challenge these popular concepts of what happened in the Soviet Union, I am going to back them up with research, citations, and a bibliography. If you keep that open mind, hopefully you will learn what is true, what has been exaggerated, and what out-and-out lies we have been told about the USSR. So far, we've covered the classic who, what, when, where, why. My name is Daniel. I'm a Marxist-Leninist who wants to put together a comprehensive podcast series on the Soviet Union of the 20th century for the purposes of educating and dispelling the propaganda we've all been fed, so that we can learn from the Soviet Union's successes and failures in our own struggle for emancipation from capitalism. That just leaves the how. That is, how is this podcast going to proceed? What form will it take? Here again, and trust me, I do not like doing this and will not make a habit of it. I have to talk a little bit about myself. The thing is, I'm a busy guy. As a member of the proletariat class, I have to sell my time and labor in order to make a living. As a father and a husband, I have certain non-negotiable demands on my time. Podcasting cannot be my full-time job. I already have one of those, and as the sole provider for my family, I have to make sure the bills are paid. So this podcast will only ever be a hobby. It will be a hobby to which I will devote as much of my limited free time as possible, and it will be, in every sense, a labor of love. I'm excited and a little daunted to be starting this project, but I regret to say I cannot make any guarantees as to a schedule. I know most podcasts maintain some sort of regular programming, but I am just not in a position to do that, so I'm not going to make a promise here I know I cannot keep. I work anywhere from 40 to 60 hours a week, including sometimes entire weekends, and that does not include helping my partner maintain a household and raise our family. But here's what I can say. It may be that in 1 month I put together a string of 3 or 4 shorter episodes, then the next month I may only be able to put out 1 episode, in which case I'll try to make it a big one. My general programming goal is between 1.5 and 2 hours of content in any calendar month. Some topics I plan on covering lend themselves to either shorter or longer episodes naturally, so I'll have to take it as it comes. However, there is one promise I am very comfortable in making, so here it is. I promise I'm not going to stop until we get to the end of the narrative. I am not the kind of person who starts a race and does not finish it. Even if I have to slow my pace to a crawl, I will cross that finish line. Given all this, I really have no idea how long it's going to take me to complete this series. I don't want to rush. My entire goal is to be thorough, to provide context, and talk about the things I feel are important, or are too often glossed over. But at the same time, I don't want to drag this out forever, or get so bogged down in the minutiae of history that the narrative loses all substance. The subject matter I'm tackling is so complex that I could, if I were so inclined, talk about the Soviet Union for the rest of my life. But I am not so inclined. I have in my head an approximate number of episodes I think this might take me. I'll let you know at the end if I was even close. With that said, I can share a general plan for the beginning of this podcast series. The World Historical Project of the USSR was to be guided by the Bolsheviks' understanding of Karl Marx's analysis of capitalism and view of world history, as well as by Vladimir Lenin's theories and insights into how to actually move past capitalism into socialism and then communism. I could start our story on December 30th, 1922, when this new state was officially formed, when the Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Transcaucasian Soviet republics signed the treaty entering into this union. But, as we all know, historical events don't just happen one day. History is a never-ending series of events, with causes becoming effects and effects becoming causes in an infinite loop. So to really understand the origins of the USSR and what its leaders were aiming for, we have to start before the actual founding of the country. But the history of the lands that would eventually constitute the Soviet Union stretch back at least a millennium before the founding of the USSR and cover approximately 1/6 of the world's landmass. And then, there's also the matter of the foundational philosophies of Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, and Vladimir Lenin. Does that mean that we have to cover, in depth, 1,000 years of history across Eurasia, as well as the 150 years of contentious socialist theory and philosophy leading up to the foundation of the USSR? Well, no. I mean, we could. These subjects are all fascinating, at least in my opinion. But if the goal of this series is to cover the history of the Soviet Union for the benefit of understanding our current struggle against capitalism and to extract useful lessons, we do not need to start with the founding of Kiev and Rus. Sorry, Prince Oleg. Another time, perhaps. But since we do need to start somewhere, here's the plan I've worked out. I'm going to take a couple of episodes to provide us with the necessary foundation of the guiding philosophies of the Soviet Union, Marxism, and Leninism. Then, we'll move on to an introduction of the cast of characters, as it were, a brief outline of all the individuals and groups that are important for the revolutionary period. The Bolsheviks, obviously, are going to be front and center, but we also need to know who they were acting with and against. So we'll also talk about groups like the Mensheviks, the SRs, the Cadets, even the Tsar will make an appearance. After that, we'll get a basic grounding in the history leading up to our starting point. I've determined that to be February 1917, but if we just parachute into the middle of a revolution that has been building for nearly a century, we will be ill-equipped to make any sense of it. so we will have to get the prologue out of the way before we're actually ready to get into the action, namely the overthrow of the Tsarist regime in February 1917. That prologue will start somewhere around the reign of the Tsar Alexander II, since his emancipation of the serfs, both the old problems it solved and the new problems it spawned but failed to address, is really the starting point for the long chain of events that inexorably lead up to February 1917. From there, we'll take a look at the Russian revolutions of 1917 at a pace somewhere between a record-breaking speedrun and a 104-episode saga, probably about 10 to 12 episodes. And from there, well, we'll be in the thick of it, won't we? Now, I know it's maybe not great to spend the first several episodes of a history podcast just going through a bunch of philosophical tenets and what amounts to a big list of names and dates. But I'm doing it this way for two reasons. First, the Soviet Union was the first conscious effort by the masses of an entire nation to build a better world than the one that existed for them at the time. It really is of vital importance to understand Marxism and Leninism to gain a working understanding of the motivations and reasoning behind the Soviet Union, and why certain decisions were made and actions taken. And second, once the action starts, I don't want to get bogged down by the endless digressions explaining this tenet of Marxism or that position of Lenin, or who the SRs were and why the Mensheviks were so ineffective. So I think it's best to just get this out of the way early so the narrative can get off to a smooth start. Of course, as we move forward, if you need a refresher on any of this material, well, the episodes won't be going anywhere. So there you have it, a full accounting of what to expect in this series. But before I wrap up this pilot episode, I have two last things I want to share. One, as I mentioned, podcasting is not my full-time job. However, even if I have the opportunity to, I'm not going to monetize this series with ads. Since I get my income from elsewhere, I am in a unique position not to have to start every episode suggesting you try this mattress or test drive that car. In the spirit of communism, this program will always be 100% free for all and ad-free. However, I will be setting up a Patreon page in case any of you feel like helping me support this hobby. The money will go to things like buying the books I need for my research and covering the costs of publishing a podcast on today's internet, or just as a thank you or a show of solidarity. Perhaps if enough people donate, I can turn this into a kind of supplemental income which will allow me to pull back from my full-time job and dedicate more time to the show, which I'm not going to lie, would be amazing. If any of you choose to donate, know that it will be greatly appreciated, and I promise to put it to good use. Go to patreon.com/sovietpod to sign up. I know Patreon channels usually offer a lot of extra goodies for signing up, but I don't have anything planned at the moment because I'm focused on just getting this project off the ground. So your subscriptions will be mostly to help me out at first. But who knows, if this podcast becomes successful and you all, dear listeners, let me know what little bonus goodies you would like, I'm certainly not against the idea of providing a little something more for my patrons. And two, if you're listening to this series or listen to history podcasts in general, chances are you've heard of one Mike Duncan. I came across him way back when he was just starting the podcast series Revolutions, although at the time I was actually listening to his maiden voyage, The History of Rome. That series was absolutely groundbreaking in the world of educational podcasting. To this day, it is one of my personal favorite history series ever produced, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. It helped me reignite my passion for Roman history and the Latin language from my high school days, and The History of Rome has been the direct inspiration for countless other history and education podcasts, including this one. His second series, Revolutions, at the time of this recording, is on its 11th season. While the entire show is fantastic and I highly recommend every season, I'm going to draw your attention to his 10th season, the epic 54-hour retelling of the Russian revolutions, the 1904-05 revolution, the 1917 February revolution, and the Great Socialist Revolution of October 1917. The reason I bring this up is because, obviously, that series and this one are going to overlap, at least at first. Mike's focus on that series was just the revolutionary period. My focus, however, is on the history of the entire Soviet Union. So what took Mike dozens of recorded hours and years of real time to produce, I'm going to necessarily be dispensing with in a relative handful of episodes. Now, if you really want a detailed blow-by-blow account of 1917, along with all the historical and social context you would ever need, Mike Duncan's Season 10 of Revolutions is the place to go. But rest assured, I will also be covering the necessary material so as not to make a different show required listening. My show will stand on its own two feet, and as a communist, my viewpoint on the subject matter will be radically different from Mike's, particularly the period after the October Revolution. But I did just want to acknowledge the influence Mike Duncan has had on the podcasting world in general, and on this newbie podcaster specifically. So Mike, on the off chance you ever hear this, thank you for the inspiration. And that does it. I'll see you next time as we start to examine what happens when the workers of a country, if not the world, unite.